KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. New Mexico has the highest rate of suspects killed by police in the region. Here's the Mountain West News Bureau's Robin Vincent.
New Mexico resident Elaine Maestas says if you were in need, her sister Alicia Lucero was there to help.
Even if it was like the last of her money, the last $20, it didn't matter if you were a friend, a family member, or somebody that she just met, she would help you out.
The sisters were close. Lucero was a loving aunt to Maestas' children and a caregiver for her father when he became ill. But after she got in a car accident,
we really noticed a drastic change that she was starting to not really be herself.
Doctors found Lucero had a brain tumor. She underwent surgery and was receiving treatments. But that's when she began having panic attacks, seizures, and acting erratically. One night, Lucero's cousin called the cops after Lucero hit her uncle in the head. Police responded and escalated the situation.
I remember my uncle calling me and he said, "Elaine, like, I need you to sit down." And I knew right when he said that, like, something was wrong with Alicia.
On July 22nd, 2019, Bernalillo County Sheriff's deputies shot Alicia Lucero 21 times. The police report paints a picture of chaos. Lucero, at 4 feet 11 inches, reportedly emerged from her trailer carrying a knife after officers repeatedly commanded her to come out. The report says police tased Lucero, but she kept going. Lucero's cousin, meanwhile, says he never saw the knife. Again, Maestas.
My sister's death was completely preventable. And the sad thing is that her life was taken by the men that were called to help her.
People in the Mountain West are killed by police at a rate more than 1.5 times the national average, with New Mexico at the top of the list. That's something Maestas points to often in her advocacy. She's become a vocal police reform proponent. But, she says, police in the state have been resistant to change. Here's New Mexico Police Union leader Sergeant Jose Carrasco pushing back against reforms introduced in the most recent legislative session.
If these bills pass the way you guys have them, there will be no law enforcement left.
Among Carrasco's concerns was the New Mexico Civil Rights Act. It did pass. The new law removes qualified immunity, a legal doctrine that protected police from civil lawsuits. New Mexico's Speaker of the House, Brian Egolf, was a co-sponsor. He says efforts to work with police on reform have largely failed because they refuse to recognize the problem.
You've got to call it out. You have to acknowledge the problem. But you also need to call out unfair criticism from law enforcement.
Egolf points to a Department of Justice investigation that found Albuquerque Police Department routinely uses excessive force. But DOJ says at least one recommendation has, quote, fallen on deaf ears. Over in Nevada, State Senator Dallas Harris took a page from Colorado's reform playbook to write several measures. The black lawmaker points to policing's racist past to help explain its problematic present.
Police units in the United States were born of slave patrols. No more than 60 or so years ago, it was a police officer's job to pull me off of a lunch counter.
After George Floyd's murder, Nevada legislators banned chokeholds and required officers to intervene when another cop is using excessive force. Now Harris is sponsoring bills that include measures like data collection and qualified immunity, to name a few. She says Nevada's historic protests last year signal that
the citizens of Nevada are with me.
Across the region, activists have precipitated cultural shifts, and they say the battle has just begun. In Utah, where big protests transpired after Floyd's killing, Lex Scott of Black Lives Matter Utah says the state's recent legislative session left her disappointed, and now she's looking to launch ballot initiatives.
I don't want to be a negative Nelly over here, but there just two things that we wanted.
Utah passed some reforms this session, and one in particular that policing experts extol, data collection. But Scott wanted independent oversight and the prompt release of body cam footage. Chris Burbank is with the Center for Policing Equity and a former Salt Lake City chief of police. He agrees that these reforms don't go far enough, and he wants fundamental change.
Why do we make traffic stops? Why do we arrest misdemeanors? Right? These are the types of things that if you no longer engage in that behavior, you no longer have the bias.
Burbank says we've tried to make ending racism a hearts and minds issue to no avail. So instead, he says we need to limit the activities police respond to, like Alicia Lucero's mental health crisis.
The criminal justice system has never solved the problem of drug or alcohol addiction or mental health or homelessness.
But Burbank points out, those problems still tend to occupy the bulk of police attention all across the nation. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Robin Vincent.
Funding for the Mountain West News Bureau made possible in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. There are growing concerns about conditions inside a massive facility for migrant teens at Fort Bliss. El Paso Congresswoman Veronica Escobar visited the emergency intake shelter recently, and she says both the size of the tents and the amount of time kids are held there are problems. KTEP's Angela Kocherka has more.
I spoke at random with kids, and I did not meet a single child who was in custody fewer than 40 days. That is alarming. The emergency intake facilities are intended to be an emergency response.
Escobar says the goal is for kids to stay about 2 weeks while caseworkers look for alternatives, including relatives or sponsors. The Congresswoman is concerned about supervision in the enormous tents and oversight of contractors providing services. She says some of the boys told her they did not have a change of clean clothing.
Their items were lost in the laundry or they never got them back. And I can tell you that it was obvious to me.
The Department of Health and Human Services in an emailed statement said the Fort Bliss emergency intake site is providing required standards of care. I'm Angela Kocherga in El Paso.
More border news now. An increasing number of American citizens have been apprehended as they have tried to smuggle illegal drugs into the U.S., since the start of the pandemic. For more than a year, the closure of the U.S.-Mexico border to non-essential traffic has limited the number of foreign citizens entering the U.S. by land. The rules have been extended until at least June 21st. But Mexican authorities have allowed most U.S. citizens to walk or drive south across the border with relative ease. Law enforcement officials and drug trafficking experts say the border rules and their lopsided enforcement are driving the rise in U.S. citizens involved in borderland drug busts. Well, New Mexico experienced its highest drought levels in the month of May since 2013. About 80% of the state was in extreme and exceptional drought, the two worst categories. Only about 4% of the state was this drought-stricken at that time last year. KUNM's Nash Jones spoke with Julie Ann Overton, public affairs officer for the Santa Fe National Forest, about what this looks like on the ground and how you can prepare to get outdoors safely this summer.
Conditions across New Mexico are pretty dire in terms of the drought. And I know that for this wildfire season, which is upon us, June is usually our worst month. The fire personnel on my forest are extremely concerned about drought conditions.
And so what does that look like? What are you seeing in the Santa Fe National Forest?
We do a lot of different measurements. We take moisture levels in different kinds of fuels, everything from pine needle litter to big deadened down logs. And we are finding that those measurements are at almost record levels.
Wow.
In other words, everything on the forest is dry, dry, dry. So it will not take much in terms of a lightning strike or an abandoned campfire for a wildfire to really take off.
Rainfall last month for the Rocky Mountains into the west was the second driest on record, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Though we have seen some rainy days over the last week here in New Mexico, do storms like that make any kind of measurable difference in the outlook for the fire season or some of the drought conditions that you mentioned?
The recent rainfall we've had, while it certainly helps, to tell you the truth, things are so very dry that while very welcome, the rain that we got recently is not really enough to put a dent in these conditions.
I see.
We're hoping, fingers crossed, that we have a quote-unquote normal monsoon season in July. The last time that we chatted with one of the National Weather Service meteorologists who really focuses on fire weather, they were still predicting a quote-unquote normal monsoon season, but who knows what that really means anymore?
No doubt. We haven't seen a lot of things that have been normal as of late. So many of the schools across the state start summer break this week, and families may begin planning some camping trips throughout the summer. What's the outlook for the summer?
We encourage everybody to get out and enjoy their public lands. We're blessed to have some incredibly beautiful landscapes here in New Mexico. And of course, I would say that the Santa Fe National Forest is one of the best.
That's right.
But I think the most important thing I would say to visitors, especially families with kids, plan ahead. We call it know before you go. Make sure you know what kinds of fire restrictions are in place for the location you're headed. Do read up on campfire safety if campfires are allowed. Do read up on lightning safety and be bear aware. Frankly, we've got the wild critters out there too. And make sure that you share that information at an appropriate level with your kids. You know, you don't want to scare them, but you want them to be knowledgeable about some of the safety issues outside.
Great. And finally, where can people go if they're looking for updates on the current restrictions or some of these safety tips?
Yeah, there are lots and lots of resources available online. Our website will have all kinds of information about fire restrictions. NMFireInfo.com will tell you where wildfires are currently burning. Other websites that are really valuable are Leave No Trace. That gives you the seven principles, the idea being leave your public lands in at least as good a condition as they were when you found them. We had a terrible issue last year with garbage all over the forest, people just leaving bags of garbage. It's very dangerous for the wildlife, and it makes a mess because they tear into those bags and spread it all over. So the saying is pack it in, pack it out, but I like to say pack it in and take it home.
There you go. Julianne Overton, Public Affairs Officer with the Santa Fe National Forest. Thanks so much for your time.
You're very welcome, Nash. Thank you.
KRWG News This Week. I'm Fred Martino. Great to be with you. Business news now, and manufacturing companies in Santa Teresa are looking to ramp up production. Anthony Moreno discussed economic development and trade at the border with Border Industrial Association President and CEO Jerry Pacheco.
Jerry, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Anthony. Thank you.
How has the pandemic impacted economic development and trade here in New Mexico's southern border?
From an export standpoint, our exports, comparing 2020 to 2019, 2019 was a record year for us. But our exports across the board were down 21% in 2020, mostly because of the pandemic. But on the bright side, our exports to Mexico, which comprise the largest part of our export in general, are only down 8%. The trade war with China that we're experiencing as a nation is really impacting our exports to Asia. And that seems to be a major factor of why we saw such a fall last year. But from a construction standpoint at the border here, 2020, I tell everybody, was the best year we've ever had in terms of recruiting new companies and constructing new space. Between 2020 and 2021, we will have constructed, or we will be constructing, 1.33 million square feet of new space down here at the border.
Now, you mentioned the trade war with China. Has that impacted how current businesses there at the border are making their future plans?
Well, it's interesting. We think that because of that trade war with China, that puts us in a position to seize in on opportunity. For example, in the last 2 years, we recruited three companies based out of Taiwan. And all three of them are really hedging their bets because they're kind of caught between China and the United States. They want to have a presence in Asia, but they also want to have a presence in the United States because a lot of the products that they're manufacturing would be hit by a 35% tariff, which could make them very non-competitive or uncompetitive, rather, with their competition.
Can you kind of give us an understanding of what sorts of jobs are going to be coming into the area?
Well, we have, I'll rattle off some companies here. We have Admiral Cable, which was the first Taiwanese company that we recruited. That's going to be making power cables and multi-outlet strips. We have Zentria, which is the second Taiwanese company we recruited. They are going to be making semi-truck trailer walls. If you can imagine a semi-truck trailer, the walls are what they manufacture. We also have Symmetric, which is a barcode label manufacturer, also from Taiwan. We have a PPE company called Prent that's coming to build 120,000 square foot space here to manufacture gloves, like for surgeries and what have you. W Silver Recycling is building 120,000 square foot building here. They have a major footprint in Santa Teresa, but they're going to expand that footprint. Plus, we just completed building about 500,000 square feet of new speculative space, 315,000 by a company out of Dallas, Texas, and 183,000 by Franklin Mountain Industrial, which is an El Paso-based company. So a lot of activity happening here at the border.
What challenges are companies facing there right now during this pandemic?
Well, just keeping employees safe. A lot of companies, for example, that weren't operating a third shift started adding a third shift. That way you space your employees apart better. A lot of protocol in terms of hygiene and keeping people socially distant. We also embarked through the Border Industrial Association, one of our members that we really, really took advantage of during the pandemic here is the hospitals at Providence. We conducted a company-by-company vaccination program, which was just wonderful that the whole workforce of a certain company could sign up and very quickly get vaccinated over here in the hospitals of Providence. So a lot of PPE being acquired in our industrial base. And the irony, Anthony, is that as we come out of this bad recession and we try to put the pandemic behind us, our businesses are trying to expand their production as quickly as possible because we have a big automotive manufacturing presence here, and we have a big consumer electronics sector here. And those areas are expanding. So we really need companies to expand their production here, but we are experiencing certain barriers. It's hard. It's very hard to find employees to come work. You can come to the industrial parks down here, and you're going to see companies with now hiring signs all over the place, and we're scrambling to find employees.
Jerry Pacheco is president and CEO of the Border Industrial Association. He is also the executive director of the International Business Accelerator, and his column, his syndicated column, is Business Across Borders. Jerry, thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Thank you, Anthony. Thank you for having me.
You can watch that full interview with Jerry Pacheco on the Fronteras page. It's in the local TV section at krwg.org. Also, look for local viewpoints under our news section. That's where you'll find Jerry Pacheco's regular column. We're proud to bring it to you. Well, big news this week. You've undoubtedly heard about it. We broke the story at krwg.org. New Mexico is the latest state to offer cash prizes to adult residents who get a COVID-19 vaccine. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham announced the state giving out millions of dollars in prizes starting next week. The move follows similar programs in Ohio and California. Around half of eligible New Mexico residents are vaccinated, but officials are hoping to get closer to three-quarters of the population. A $5 million cash prize drawing is planned for August. Smaller prizes of $250,000 will be selected weekly. The state is also giving out museum tickets and in-state vacation packages. You'll find a link to register for the prizes if you've been vaccinated at krwg.org. That's where you'll also find a link on our homepage to register for the vaccination. Well, with kids as young as 12 receiving Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine, young people in New Mexico and across the region are talking about what is motivating them to get the shot. Here's an audio postcard from the Mountain West News Bureau.
Hi, my name is Taylor DiNiazzi.
I'm Ezra Visser.
My name is Molly Buckles.
My first name is Oliver, and my last name is Rogers.
Hello, my name is Shandine Willie.
A week ago, I got the vaccine.
I was a little bit scared, not because of the symptoms or anything. I just have a fear of needles.
At first, I didn't want to get it because I was scared because I thought I was still going to get the virus or something.
I wanted to get it pretty much right away just because not only I knew I had at least some type of protection against COVID.
I was like, okay, maybe it's not all that bad. Maybe I should get it. I haven't gotten a shot in a while.
It's okay. It'll be nice and easy. Do you want to let your arm hang nice like a spaghetti noodle?
Yeah.
Okay. Ready?
It's not all that bad. See?
Did it sting?
A little bit. It didn't hurt like I thought it would. I feel relieved.
It feels exciting because a year ago today, we didn't even have a vaccine. And now I'm just getting like closer to the second dose day by day.
When COVID was still like outraging, like we couldn't hang out with any friends or do anything because it's such a bad virus and we didn't want to take it home.
Whenever I would go to the store, I would just be in constant fear of like touching something and then someone who probably has the virus has touched that.
I think I'm more of a germaphobe now.
It was a struggle too with school because of how hard it was like online and stuff.
It's been so hard and tiring and draining.
It was much harder to focus than when I was in school normally.
I wouldn't want to do it again.
I haven't been able to do as much sleepovers or hangouts with my friends.
When we're all in person, we just like to talk and like laugh. But then like over the phone, it's different.
We mostly just like met in parks and hung out outside.
This past week, I went out with my friends finally, and I got to see them again. It made me feel happy because I haven't seen anyone besides my family this whole entire pandemic, and just seeing them again just like made me want to cry, but I didn't want to in front of them. So I was just kind of happy the whole entire time.
So getting the vaccine will help me do that again.
I'm also looking forward to playing sports again.
I wanted to play football when I'm fully vaccinated.
Restaurants, because there are a couple really good ones in town that I have definitely missed eating at.
I'm looking forward to going back to school in person and not online.
The concerts and the traveling again. I've been really wanting to see Harry Styles and then Billie Eilish too with her new tour that's coming up.
I know that most of my friends have been vaccinated.
I actually talked to some of my friends and they actually don't want to get it.
They probably should get it just for like their parents' safety and relative safety.
It doesn't really hurt, it's just a slight pinch. And it's been tested on other kids, like 12 through 15, and they've been fine.
After you get it, you're just going to feel more free and safe.
It didn't take much to get some more safety in my life.
Funding for the Mountain West News Bureau provided in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Well, speaking of kids, New Mexico's more cautious school districts are signaling that learning will be in person this fall. Urban school districts like Albuquerque and Santa Fe were slower to reopen doors this spring. Both districts have confirmed in recent weeks that classes will be held in person this fall, with a few exceptions. Currently, around half of New Mexico's public school students have chosen to finish the semester remotely after state officials gave the green light to reopen. Students wanting to continue in remote learning this fall are being encouraged to register now for online-only schools in their districts, including in Albuquerque and Santa Fe. Well, big news locally in education this week. Ralph Ramos named superintendent of Las Cruces Public Schools. He was a middle school principal in Las Cruces before he became interim superintendent. Madison Staten has our report.
Ralph Ramos will officially take over as superintendent for Las Cruces Public Schools following a 4-1 vote by the LCPS Board of Education. Ramos, who has been acting as interim superintendent since March 1st, says he will work to ensure continued improvement within the district.
It's not about myself. It's about the team that we have with LCPS here. Our culture is to create a better place for kids, and that's what we're, our goal is always there. But I'm like lost with words right now. I know we have a lot of work together. I know we're going to do it. I know that you will be proud of Las Cruces Public Schools and everything we continue doing for students.
School board member Terry Dahlman was the only one to vote no, advocating for more transparency in the selection process. She made a motion during the work session to hold a special informational meeting, but could not garner enough support from the rest of the board.
I'm asking for the consideration to postpone this particular line item, or item rather. Allow the superintendent search committee to come together and present their findings or their recommendations so that the community can hear from the search committee.
Ultimately, the board offered Ramos $180,000, $10,000 more than predecessor Karen Trujillo's starting salary. Ramos brings 28 years of experience within the LCPS community to the job, working as both a teacher and administrator. He says he understands the learning challenges the pandemic has created for students and is working with LCPS staff to address concerns.
We need to come together after this pandemic. To do what's right for kids is not easy, but we're going to do it. I learned so much in this short time that I've been here. We've missed out through the pandemic, all these different things that have happened. And we got to bring it together and fine-tune it. We're going to do what's best for our kids. School board members, thank you so much again for your confidence, and it's time to get to work.
School board president Ray Jaramillo acknowledges the search for a superintendent was done quickly, saying that finding a permanent leader to oversee pandemic-related challenges took priority.
This superintendent search was very speedy. I believe it was 45, 50 days, something like that. I think one of the most important things for me anyway was that we had a leader in a position to begin our next school year, probably the most important school year that I can remember in my 46 years being on this earth following a COVID pandemic. And it was very important to me that we try to do everything we can to get the next person to fill Dr. Trujillo's shoes in a place where they could get acclimated and we can get to a great start of this next school year.
Losing out on the position is finalist Dr. Oscar Rico from El Paso. Jaramillo says he understands that some members of the public were advocating for Rico, but is calling on the community to rally around the new superintendent.
Really what we need to do is bring both sides together. What I ask is to give Mr. Ramos a chance and hold him accountable. We will hold him accountable. Hold us accountable as a board, and I want you to hold us accountable. I welcome that.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
Well, more education news now that's making news all across the country. A North Texas high school valedictorian used her graduation speech this week to make a statement for all women. Paxton Smith of Lake Highlands High School in Dallas spoke out against Senate Bill 8. The so-called heartbeat bill was signed into law by Governor Greg Abbott. It bans abortions in Texas after 6 weeks, with no exceptions for rape or incest. Smith called the legislation a war on the rights of her body and those of other women.
I have dreams and hopes and ambitions. Every girl graduating today does. And we have spent our entire lives working towards our future. And without our input and without our consent, our control over that future has been stripped away from us.
Smith's address, which garnered national attention, as I mentioned, was a surprise for the school. She scrapped a previously approved speech to deliver the call for abortion rights. The new Texas abortion restrictions go into effect in September. Well, for a while, it looked like a nonprofit organization was going to be contracted to care for homeless dogs in Doñana County, but the organization decided not to move forward. Here's an update from commentator Peter Goodman.
A controversial sole source contract between the county and Barkhouse is off the table. The plan, which concerned spaying, neutering, and rescuing dogs and flying them out of state, generated much controversy. Documents obtained recently by citizens under the Public Records Act appear to contradict some public statements by county officials. I'd also wondered why County Manager Fernando Macias, a former judge, seemed untroubled by a court judgment against Kelly Barker, who now heads Barkhouse, for defrauding folks of $50,000 plus. Macias noted that the 2009 judgment occurred more than 10 years ago and couldn't be used in court. I thought it should factor into her credibility score with the county. She was in her 50s when it happened, not 19. Macias stressed that the contract for a 6-month pilot project would have allowed the county to evaluate the work. I was also troubled that Barkhouse attacked its critics, had a lawyer send threatening letters, and even claimed quote-unquote sabotage by county employees. Emails contradict several things that Jeannie Quintero or Macias had said. Commissioner Shannon Reynolds asked Macias in a public meeting what the county had paid for a March 29th chartered flight carrying dogs. Macias replied, nothing. Fact was, the county paid more than $13,000. Macias readily concedes he was wrong. I don't see him copied on those emails. But why didn't somebody correct him or later whisper the facts to him so he could correct himself? And who had authority to sign such a check? Citizens claimed Barkhouse got to keep Barkhouse dogs in the county hold facility. Officials told the public there were no Barkhouse dogs there, and Barkhouse employees had no access. But in one February email, Barker tells Quintero, these are not county dogs. These are ours. Another discusses putting the Barkhouse dogs and county dogs in separate wings. Macias says that legally any dog in the facility was county owned, but Barker and Quintero may or may not have acted accordingly. February emails also show Barker reaming out Quintero because a county employee was honest with a veterinarian about the maturity of some puppies. Macias correctly points out that many of these emails didn't reach his level, and that Quintero made most of the questionable public statements. Still, the amount of apparent misinformation is troubling, and many say Macias is a micromanager. I don't agree that this involved corruption, but due diligence and accurate communication to public and commission were inadequate. County officials also seemed to circle the wagons around Barkhouse publicly, but Quintero and Barkhouse are out now. Still, commissioners should ask hard questions. But I agree with Macias that we need to do something about our homeless dog population, starting with a ramped-up countywide spay and neuter program. The county plans to do just that.
You can read or listen to all of Peter's columns in the local viewpoint section under the news tab at krwg.org. His opinions are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRWG or NMSU. A Texas conservation group tied to the father of fracking has released a list of recommendations for how to protect one of the state's most pristine regions from energy sprawl. That tops environmental news this week on the program. Marfa Public Radio's Travis Bubenik has more on a new report from the Respect Big Bend Coalition.
The report's meant to be a kind of roadmap for balancing new energy projects with land conservation in the state's Big Bend region. The project is connected to the Mitchell Foundation, founded in part by fracking pioneer George Mitchell, who himself acknowledged that the fracking boom came with real environmental concerns. The report lays out methods for energy firms to work with landowners and be more careful about where exactly they build. Researchers also developed an interactive mapping tool to help with that. University of Texas law professor Melinda Taylor leads the project.
I think the next step would be to take this tool to a particular play or a particular area where there is some energy development planned and to test it in that context.
Still, Taylor acknowledges the project hasn't yet led to any firm commitments from companies or landowners to actually follow the report's recommendations. In Marfa, I'm Travis Bubenik.
And more environmental news now. The Biden administration's 30 by 30 goal to fight climate change by designating new public lands won't be possible without congressional action. The New Mexico News Connection's Roz Brown reports.
The 30 by 30 initiative, also called the America the Beautiful campaign, aims to preserve 30% of the nation's lands and water by 2030. But its pledge to fight the climate crisis could face hurdles. Announced by the Biden administration earlier this year, the initiative acknowledges what's called a tipping point in damage done to the natural world and decisive action needed to reverse that damage. It could be a heavy lift in New Mexico, where oil and gas funds from extraction made up more than a third of the state's general fund in 2020. Nonetheless, Kim Pope with the Sierra Club says New Mexico may have the most to gain from the 30 by 30 goal.
Nearly 760,000 acres of natural lands were lost to development in New Mexico between 2001 and 2017.
The Environmental Protection Agency estimates that fossil fuel extraction on public lands contributes to at least 23% of greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. Critics say the Biden proposal lacks a baseline of how much land and water already is under conservation or specific details on how it will conduct its tally over the next decade. In a presentation to the Sierra Club Rio Grande chapter this week, Pope said it's critical to focus on the acreage aspect, but also get people involved who want to solve the climate crisis, preserve existing wild space, and protect more nature.
We want to work with communities and make sure that the conservation efforts make sense for the community, that are equitable for all communities that lack green space or lack outdoor space.
Pope says 12% of the country's lands are currently protected. In New Mexico, where 47% of the state is designated public land, only 6% are protected through state and federal designation and conservation easements. So far, 50 counties and 70 U.S. mayors have committed to the 30 by 30 goal. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
We move to criminal justice news now, and a story we've been following for years. An Alamogordo woman has been indicted for murder in the 2017 death of a man whose body was found in a Mesilla ditch. The 3rd Judicial District's Attorney's Office announced this week a grand jury in Donana County indicted Brianna Terry with first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder. She's also facing one count each of robbery and conspiracy to commit robbery. Prosecutors say Donana County Sheriff's detectives found more evidence through new technology. Terry and her boyfriend, Justin Bullock, are both accused of killing 18-year-old Dakota Lunsford. Lunsford's body was found in August 2017 by a farmer. His death was ruled a homicide. The U.S. Supreme Court is expected to rule this month in a case that could have a major impact in New Mexico and across the region. The court is being asked to decide if evidence involving non-native suspects collected by tribal police should be valid. The Mountain West News Bureau's Savannah Marr reports.
If you drive all 300 miles of U.S. Highway 550, you'll pass in and out of tribal land more than a dozen times, including this stretch in northern New Mexico.
You're on Pueblo of Zia, U.S. 550, mile marker 18.
That's Jerome Lucero, governor of the Zia Pueblo and also one of its police officers. He says this highway gives his department a lot of trouble because tribal officers don't always have jurisdiction over travelers here.
Yes, I have to take it into consideration if they're native or non-native.
This is a problem for tribal law enforcement across the U.S. who don't have the same policing authority as non-tribal cops. Because of a 1978 Supreme Court decision, their authority to detain and investigate non-natives for committing crimes on reservations is extremely limited. To explain, Lucero tells me about a recent traffic stop when a driver was going 30 miles an hour in a 70 mile an hour zone. When he approached, the driver's pupils looked like tiny dots and he was acting strangely.
I could see visually that he had heroin in the middle console on top with a bunch of syringes in his door and stuff.
Normally, this would add up to probable cause to arrest him for driving while intoxicated. But because the driver was non-native and Lucero was a tribal officer, he didn't have the authority even to detain him. Lucero had to call for backup from non-tribal law enforcement.
County didn't even want to come up. They just flat out said that they were busy.
Lucero couldn't arrest the driver himself, so after 4 hours of waiting, he was out of options. Lucero impounded the man's car and dropped him in the off-reservation town of Bernalillo.
He was a free man.
Situations like this aren't unique in Indian country. This year, a similar case came before the United States Supreme Court. This time from the Crow Reservation in southern Montana. Joel Williams is with the Native American Rights Fund. He says this case started with a Crow tribal police officer who approached a pickup truck that was parked on the shoulder of a remote stretch of highway. It was 1 o'clock in the morning.
The police officer noticed that there was a child in the back seat, firearms in the front seat.
He says that the driver, named Joshua Cooley, seemed to be intoxicated. So the Crow officer detained him, and while he was waiting for a county officer to come make the arrest,
he found what appeared to be methamphetamine and a pipe in the vehicle.
Cooley was indicted on federal drug and weapons charges, but because he was not a tribal citizen, a district court judge threw out the evidence collected by the tribal officer. The officer lacked jurisdiction, the court ruled. The case went to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which agreed. Williams says the ruling makes things worse for tribal police officers.
Now, unless they're actually witnessing a crime occurring, essentially, then they're not going to have that authority.
Williams says it widens an existing law enforcement loophole for crimes from burglary to domestic violence.
Gosh, that really poses a very serious public safety issue.
Before the Supreme Court, attorneys for the driver, Joshua Cooley, argued that loophole shouldn't be his problem. Attorney Eric Henkel said non-natives shouldn't be subject to Crow tribal government authority or policing.
If Mr. Cooley's civil rights are violated here, there's nothing he can do because of tribal sovereign immunity and this all occurring outside the structure of the Constitution.
If the court upholds the Ninth Circuit ruling, it will make it even more difficult for tribal officers across the country to police non-natives. But even if the court rules the other way, it doesn't mean tribal police will gain new authority. It would likely take an act of Congress to solve this problem. That's what Officer Lucero, the governor of Zia Pueblo, wants to see.
We don't have jurisdiction here on our reservation, but when us Native Americans get off the reservation, they have full jurisdiction over us. So what's the difference? Makes my heart sad to see that happening to us Native Americans.
The U.S. Supreme Court is expected to rule on this case sometime this month. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Savannah Marr.
Funding for the Mountain West News Bureau provided in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. On the Health Watch this week, during the pandemic, many women have postponed breast cancer screenings. KERA's Sam Baker talked about the importance of getting a mammogram with Dr. Allison DePasquale, an oncologist with Texas Breast Specialists.
Screening mammograms were actually postponed and canceled from the hospital standpoint to protect patients. But now that we know more and more about this virus and we have taken the correct precautions, screening mammograms have opened up.
Precautions such as?
Such as we are limiting the amount of people that are in the waiting room and that can come in for a mammogram. You're scheduling an exact time so that you're not waiting around to get your imaging. In between mammograms, they're sterilizing the rooms, and the patients then are put into another holding room by themselves where then they can leave after their imaging is done. So really, we're taking more of a scheduled approach to the way we do things, and the extra precautions include the sterilization process.
So with all of that going on, then what's causing them to either postpone or cancel?
I think it's a combination of fear and also just the unknown. During this pandemic, your mind is somewhere else. You may not be remembering, oh, hey, it's time for my mammogram. This pandemic is not going to end soon, and we have to take care of ourselves. So really focus on reminding yourself that if you're a couple months late, it's okay. Just come on in.
So there's no concern then about somebody who maybe has pushed back a screening for a couple of months. That's not such a bad thing.
You know, even if it's pushed back 6 months or a year, we do need to get that mammogram. So it doesn't matter how delayed you are. You just need to come in and get that mammogram. And then if there's anything that is suspicious, then a diagnostic mammogram would come next. And that, again, is taking the same precautions, the same way that we do things, so that we're doing it in a safe process. I also think the message to patients should be knowledge is power. So going in, taking the worry out of your mind of getting a clean bill of health and a screening mammogram, you can just take that off your plate.
What bothers you about them not doing it?
Not doing it means that they could have something underlying that's missed. And if cancer or any sort of suspicious masses are in the breast and are not detected early, and they wait another year or two and come in, then they may present in a later stage. So really, the reason why mammograms save lives is because it's early detection. It detects it before you can feel it, before you have any skin changes, before you have any symptoms.
Because I know there are some forms of cancer that sometimes don't present themselves until later stages. Is that the case with breast cancer?
No, there are some rare types of breast cancer that can present a little abnormally. If you're getting your yearly screening mammograms, because that year-to-year basis, and it takes long for typical breast cancer to grow, it's found in a very early stage that is highly treatable and highly curable.
Are there some women who don't need to get a mammogram every year?
So really the answer to that is unlikely. The majority of people should get a mammogram if you are average risk. It means you do not have a family history of breast cancer, you do not have a personal history of cancer or radiation therapy, or have had previous biopsies or abnormal mammograms. Average risk women should start at age 40 and go yearly until they no longer are healthy enough to even get a mammogram. So for everyone, that's different. You know, some people may be unhealthy at age 60 and some may be perfectly healthy at age 95. So it's really about your health, overall health. Now, for higher risk women, we actually start it earlier, depending on your risk factors, and your physician can help you decide when to start your mammogram.
Dr. DePasquale, thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you very much for having me.
Finally this week, 100 years ago, a white mob attacked Tulsa's Greenwood District, referred to as Black Wall Street. The mob killed and wounded hundreds and looted and set fire to homes and businesses. The 35-block district was reduced to ruins. Recently, a Tulsa group announced it had raised some $30 million, but its signature event marking the centennial was canceled due to a dispute over how much of that money is owed to survivors. Viola Fletcher is a survivor. She fled with her family a century ago. She is now 107, but the memories of that day, which impacted her entire life, remain strong. Fletcher testified to a House Judiciary Committee hearing to mark the centennial of the Tulsa Race Massacre.
On May 31st in 21, I went to bed at my family's home in Greenwood. Neighbors of Tulsa, the neighborhood I felt asleep in that night, was rich, not just in terms of wealth, but in culture, community, heritage, and my family had a beautiful home. We had great neighbors, and I had friends to play with. I felt safe. I had everything a child could need. I had a bright future ahead of me. Greenwood should have given me the chance to truly make it in this country. Within a few hours, all of that was gone. The night of the massacre, I was awakened by my family. My parents and five siblings were there. I was told we had to leave, and that was it. I will never forget the violence of the white mob when we left our home. I still see black men seen being shot, black bodies lying in the street. I still smell smoke and see fire. I still see black businesses being burned. I still hear airplanes flying overhead. I hear the screams. I have lived through the massacre every day. Our country may forget this history, but I cannot. I will not. And other survivors do not, and our descendants do not. When my family was forced to leave Tulsa, I lost my chance of an education. I never finished school past the fourth grade. I have never made much money in my country. State and city took a lot from me. Despite this, I spent time supporting the war effort in the shipyards of California. But most of my life, I was a domestic worker serving white families. I never made much money, but to this day, I can barely afford my everyday needs. All the while, the city of this Tulsa have unjustly used the names and stories of victims like me to enrich myself and its white allies through the 30s, million, two through the 30s million rays by the Tulsa Centennial Commissioner while I was continued to live in poverty. I am 107 year old and have never been seen justice. I pray that one day I will. I have been blessed with a long life and have seen the best and the worst of this country. I think about the terror, horror inflicted upon black people in this country every day. This subcontinued MIDI has the power to lead us down a better path. I'm asking that my country acknowledge what has been happened to me, the tremors and the pain, the loss, and I ask the survivors and descendants to be given the chance to seek justice, open the door. All of you know how easy it is to deny that a violent mob threatened your lives and took your property. For 70 years, the city of Tulsa and its stream of tremors told us that the massacre didn't happen, like we didn't see it with our own eyes. You have had me here right now. You see Mother Randall, you see my brother, Hughes Van Ellis. We live this history and we can't ignore it. It's our lives with us. Oh my goodness. We lost everything that day, our homes, our churches, our newspapers, our theaters, our lives. Greenwood represented all the best of what was possible for black people in America and for all the people. No one cared about us for almost 100 years. We and our history have been forgotten, washed away. This Congress must recognize us and our history. For black America, for the white Americans, and for all Americans, that's some justice.
107-year-old Viola Fletcher, a survivor of the Tulsa Race Massacre, an event largely ignored until now. Something to remember as you hear politicians and others try to score political points blasting educators who are working to improve education about systemic racism, its history, its present, and how it's sometimes erased or sanitized in the history books. NPR reports states like Idaho and Oklahoma have adopted laws that limit how public school teachers can talk about race in the classroom, and Republican legislatures in nearly half a dozen states have advanced similar bills. That's KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thank you so much for being with us. Broadcasting from New Mexico State University, KRWG Las Cruces, and KRXG Silver City.